What is the importance of botany growing up Maasai in the Mara? Well, ethnobotany is at the center of the Maasai identity and culture. Their diet, although mostly animal-based, relies heavily on plants as medicine. Maasai use more than 12 species of trees to clean their teeth. Malaria is still largely treated with local plants. Olive branches are used to treat pneumonia, but they are also of great ceremonial significance as it is thought to bring good luck. Velvet willow relieves backache from the constant walking that their semi-nomadic lives entail. Maasai women build homes from mud, different kinds of sedges, and lemon yellow rose mallow. They call them smoke houses because there are no windows and there's always an open fire smoldering inside. As part two of our episodes about traveling in the Mara, I am talking to Fred Ronco, a Maasai naturalist from Lemek, a village in the northern Greater Maasai Mara. For decades, Fred has been guiding photographers and film crews in the Mara, as well as visitors traveling with the award-winning safari company, Acilia Africa. Fred will share where he grew up and insights into the Maasai natural world, why stars are helpful in finding grass for cattle and water for humans, and the relationship between Maasai warriors, their cattle, and of course, lions. Welcome, Fred.
Well, I'm so happy to join you as well. Super Oleng is hello in Maasai. We all, as Maasai, we all grew up in a traditional Maasai way, which is pastoralist. So we look after the cows and we look after the land, after the wildlife, and after the domestic animals. And we live as a group, as a very close society together, who actually they do all things, not individual, but they do it as a society. For, let's say, maybe 30, 40 years ago, the whole village used to move, you know, from, you know, when they nomads, they move everyone else and then they don't have to come back. But we lost a lot of land to other tribes as the African tribes also growing, population growing up, they starting taking our land. So nowadays what we do, the family has to stay in the same place, but the cattle, the young warriors, the young Maasai Moran will move the cattle for better grazing, but after maybe 3 months when they rain, they bring the cattle back into the village. But the family has to stay in the same place to look after the land. So the children, the elder people, the females, Maasai ladies will stay in the semi-permanent homes to keep the land. But the herders, the boys, will move the cattle for better grazing. Maybe after 3 months, they'll bring the cattle back into the village after the rain.
So when you're herding, you move the herds from one place to another. What is the landscape like?
It is a savanna. So we move the herds from place to place for better grazing. So it is a nomadic system. You leave one area, and if there's not much grass there, because there's no border, no restrictions, you go to the next area where you can find some better grass for your cattle and water for your people.
I see. And how do you find the areas that have been rained on?
We actually, we don't use any meteorological instruments. We use our eyes. So you look and you see, you heard a thunder or rain, and then you know that area. But normally we scent the people to go there. So when they really need some grass, they have nothing else to do. They have to go and check the area. We still are the ones who have land. That's how the land becoming an issue with other tribes. You go there, so many of them, and they cultivate and they need land to cultivate, but their land sort of coming smaller and smaller. But as Maasai, we don't cultivate our land. We're just for grazing and all that. So we still have a really nice open space for our cattle.
Cattle is not always grazed on the same kind of grass. During the dry season, the Maasai know which grasses have a high water content so their cattle will not be thirsty. This and other plant knowledge is passed orally among the Maasai from generation to generation, including the hallucinogenic roots warriors use in confrontations with other tribes, or more importantly, during lion hunts.
The lions will kill for our traditional way that we want to become a man. So you do the lion hunt. Yeah, we track the lions to get where they are. Okay. So you wake up very early because that's something not happen every day. It's something that happen in some times or group of warriors.
I see. So when you track a lion, let's say this tradition, is it once in a lifetime, once a year?
So yeah, and it also depends on how many warriors are going through that traditional ceremony. So on that time, as a season of those warriors going through that traditional ceremonials, it has happened quite often because every warrior, he want to be seen and he want mm-hmm. to prove he's a man before the end of that stage. But actually, it is not all of them are going to do that. So I said, yeah, only on the season when the warriors are on the climax of the end of their ceremony. And before all of them get their lion mane, mm-hmm. the ceremony is finished. So I say maybe out of 100 warriors, maybe 3 warriors manage to get the lion mane. So it is, they're very, very clever the way, that is why we still have all these lions all over the Maasai land. Uh-huh. And you cannot believe how did they get all these lions, and they use lions as a passage of rituals and warriorhood. But it is a clever way they were. It's only on that climax end before they finish their ceremony. And maybe out of 100 warriors, maybe 3 or 4 warriors, the most is 10 warriors wearing the lion headdress on the ceremony. So that is how it works.
Oh, I see. So maybe one of them hunts a lion. And what do you do with the skin and the meat of the lion that you hunt?
We leave the meat. We leave the meat for vultures and other, and other predators or into the nature. The only thing we need is, or the warrior need is the mane, the head of the male lion, or the tail, or let's say the skin. The only skin that they use to go and use for the dancing to take to the ceremonial village. That's the only thing they need, the skin. These traditions still happen even today. Actually, we're on the season of warriors graduating from warrior to be junior elders going to another state. That's still happening, actually. Mm-hmm. School have taken pretty much most of all that, but actually still happen. Mm-hmm. And with the lion hunt, because of the conservancies and national reserve, mm-hmm. We're getting the return from these wild animals now. So this as a conservationist, the conservationist came back and said to the Maasai, you've been looking after these animals for hundreds and hundreds of years, mm-hmm. and you never get anything out of it. So now mm-hmm. it is a time for you to, because you've been conserving these animals anyway, you get more from the animals. So now we're having conservations. Many people like myself that has been employed by the companies and tourism companies, and so many others just because of wildlife. So now we it's getting less and less now just because of conservations. But yeah. other part of ceremonies still happen.
Oh, I see. So in reality, the hunt of the lion doesn't really happen any longer.
In small corners, it has happened. They still hunt. When the lion kill their cattle, mm-hmm. they still, if they don't get compensated, they still get to go and hunt that lion. And small other areas that are a little bit away from the protected areas, they still do some hunt, but not as much as way before. But I don't say it is a conservation actually stop them doing that.
Okay.
It is young Maasai boys, they spend more time in school now than actually being a warrior.
What do warriors do when there is no war?
They just go around and actually enjoy their meat camp. They go to the bush and take their big bulls and slaughter there and drink the different herbs we were talking earlier, root that are really make them strong. The other roots make them really crazy. I don't know, you know, just make them really strong. So they just and dance most of the time. So they use that as, you know, training. They are like training camp. You know, just do other activities, lion hunt, dance in the villages and see who can really jump nicely. Do a lot of raiding. That is the main thing. And actually, they're the ones who actually provoke the war, because they go and bring the cattle from non-Maasai tribe to bring into their tribe. So that is the main reason why they're there. We raid other tribes a lot. And we believe the cattle in the whole world belong to the Maasai. So they belong to us. And so that is on their warrior's mind. Every time when they grew up, they want to raid as much as they can, or more than what the other warriors did. You know, the previous age group who did warrior time, they raid more than them. So there is a competition. They want to be more popular than any other group. So that's what they do. They just raid cattle from non-Maasai, and that's how the war starts. Because other tribes, they say it's our cattle. And Maasai don't care. They just say, it is our cows. When they raid the cattle, they bring into the family. So there's a way that they're thinking that they're giving a family a wealth. So their family is going to get more cows when the warriors do more raiding. So every warrior will try to raid as much as he can to bring more cattle into the family. And as in all the ceremonies, you see this really beautiful and colorful Maasai shukas all across. When we used to go to Nairobi, we used to wear this cloth all over, you know, the Maasai colors in Nairobi, big cities. You know, Maasai feel a little bit intimidated because I say maybe 20 years ago, when they see you in the city with a Maasai cloth, they just say, Maasai, Maasai, everyone pointing to you like you're an animal, you're strange animals in the city. So the Maasai feel a little bit intimidated that way because, you know, somebody, you know, just bothering you in the street of Nairobi because you're wearing your traditional cloth and they feel unsafe on that way when they walk to cities with their traditional cloth. And that actually changed a lot. When you're ready to go to city, you have to put on the Western cloth, which is, they are not comfortable about it, but something I forced them to do, to put on. But as soon as they return to the village, throw that trousers away and put on the traditional cloth. But with the new constitution now, there's no one actually, everyone is allowed to wear whatever they want. So we're back into our traditional cloth now. In Nairobi, you wear Maasai cloth and all that, and no one bothering you.
I think they're the most beautiful clothes and they're so elegant. And one of my favorite things that I own is a Maasai necklace that my husband brought me from Kenya.
Oh, the wedding necklace.
Yes. And I wear it with great pride.
That's nice.
I wear it out and about in New York. That's nice. And people look at me and say, oh, what is that? And I, you know, I tell the story. But, you know, New Yorkers, nothing surprised them. So anyway, I find that I love the Maasai. How would you describe the shuka when you're wearing it?
Oh my God, it's really the most, you know, comfortable and it's still, you know, it doesn't really matter whether I go to Nairobi and all that. I still put my red shuka on top of my other cloth. It is just something. It really, you feel comfortable.
And elegant.
It is just something to do with Maasai. It is just something. It's you know, Maasai with their shuka. It's just something. I know things are forcing them to go to other clothes, you know, because it's very expensive, but the shuka and the Maasai are like one thing.
It's a symbiotic relationship.
But for many years, you know, we were using the animal skin as our cloth. We didn't have anything, you know, goat skin, and that's what we wore for many years. although they're still there for a special ceremony, you know. But when the first time missionaries came to Africa, they brought this very plain white khaki. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they saw these naked people walking around and they were giving them free the white, very white khaki. And actually, I remember when you know, I was wearing that as well, you know, one little white khaki. But the Maasai didn't like the color. So they get the red ochre from the ground and they dip to dye this, to change the white khaki that have been brought by the missionaries. And they turn it red. So we you know, they give you the white one, but actually you dip it into the red ochre water and you dry it and it just turned red. And it went on and on. There was no any other clothing in the country were made. It's only those ones that have been imported, the white khaki, until the, you know, Kenyans government starting producing their own clothes, and they struggle to find the Maasai shuka. Uh-huh. And somebody actually came with an idea, and they said, these people like the red color. And that's how now they get it. They already who are actually made out of wools and all that.
Yes.
And they painted, they make it red. So the Maasai went in and they said, oh my God, we found one already. It's been dyed. No, I don't have to dye this one. This one is red with our color. And that's how the thing started.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
It was really, really good to have a nice talk with you. And yeah, thank you.
When we experience the Mara through the eyes of the Maasai and through the stories of the savannah, we are also learning inadvertently how they use botany to thrive and survive. Plants may not be your first motivation for traveling, but without understanding their role, we don't have the complete picture. Private ownership of land is restricting access to pasture more and more. So cattle and wildebeest are competing for smaller areas of grassland, especially during the dry season. Observing how wildebeest migrate is essential for Maasai survival. Botany is the silent narrator of our lives. I hope you enjoyed this journey in the Mara along with special guests, Nikki Fitzgerald and Fred Ronco. Please review the podcast to receive the last remaining Angama cookbook. And don't forget to subscribe. For comments, please send an email to podcast@palula.us. Till next time.